The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Diagnosis of stroke, multiple sclerosis, and acute and chronic neuropathies is presented by Dr. Scott Spradlin.
All right, so stroke or brain attack. Little demographics here. The fifth leading cause of death for men. It's the fourth leading cause of death for women. It's the third leading cause of death for African Americans or blacks. It's an acute brain injury due to a vascular etiology. And a lot of times you hear the word it is of sudden onset, and it does persist more than 24 hours. It is not an accident, and if you notice, I kind of get upset when I see them called accidents, because there's only a couple accidents, and that's usually from blunt trauma. Most of the times, they're not an accident because they have modifiable and unmodifiable means. And of course, there's an associated neurological deficit or deficits to that. Now, differentiating a stroke from a TIA is quite difficult within the first 24 hours because they have the same or could have the same symptomatology. But a TIA or transient ischemic attack is a neurological deficit that lasts less than 24 hours. Modality and the criteria that we'll kind of go through here is going to be very important in the workup because essentially you want to treat them the same originally. I don't think it is, but you can check. Or take that one and see. It should be. So let's look a little bit first at stroke imaging, because when we're going to be working on a board question around a stroke, there's a couple of things that's just going to be the prevalence of trying to get you guided to get the correct answer. First, you're going to have a stim question that's going to be talking about symptoms, and then there's going to be imaging. And the most important thing is we need to work both ways. We could essentially have an image, and then the question be, what would you expect? Or we could have a question that says, here's the symptoms. What do you think it is? And so just to kind of glance ourselves into some imaging, the important thing is we want to first take a look. And of course, when you look at a CAT scan, it's like you've looked at the ones already this morning, you want to just kind of draw your line. You want to look at differences here. You can kind of see you've got certainly an area of hyperdense changes over here. You can actually see the ventricles are a little bit protruded in. And as you can look from the diagram on the right here, the most important is that it appears to be falling into that right middle cerebral area. As well as it's very, very important for us to understand some other terminology. You've got your putamen, you've got your thalamus. You can kind of evaluate those as you go. And you can see the ventricles. And if there does appear to be a little squish, as you can see here versus here, and a little bit of a shift here, definitely know you've got an event occurring. This one would certainly be a right middle cerebral artery type distribution. So there's about 795,000 strokes that occur each year. And this isn't a right slide deck, by the way. So there's one missing. So when you find it, tell me. 87% of those strokes are ischemic. Stroke kills about 130,000 Americans a year. It is one of the most costly medical items that exists. It's over $34 billion a year. And it's the leading cause of serious long-term disability. So let's look a little bit about race. It's more prevalent in blacks than whites. males more than females. Hispanics are at higher risk of lacunar infarcts. And so when you get into this, as you know, as you read about any pathology of disease, is that there's certain populations that are more prevalent than this because of their ethnic background, but also there is affordability and access to medical care. And therefore, both of those play a huge component into these being drivers. A stroke does occur in all ages. We talked about MELAS this morning. In certain senses, people are having strokes very early. We know that there are exogenous means such as drugs, most particularly cocaine, et cetera, that leads to stroke. But the prevalence of those, over 75% of those, occur in people that are over the age of 64. So let's look at the non-modifiable risk factors, and then we'll look at the modifiable ones. Age, race, sex, much as you've heard in some of the other lectures, ethnicity. Other history of items, such as fibromuscular dysplasia, history of migraine, sickle cell disease, and of course, genetics are drivers that put us at higher risk. And that's why it's very, very important to establish these risk factors above and beyond some of the modifiable ones that we'll talk about later. Laboratory data for this is much like what we've discussed earlier this morning, stratification. We've got to look at glucose for your diabetes or risk factors, look at blood counts to make sure that you're not having any type of hematological changes, coagulation abnormalities, so PTs and PTTs and INRs, because people can be prone to Leiden's factor, certain things that could make you more hypercoagulable and therefore put you at a higher risk of an infarction. Cholesterol is a risk factor, most particularly looking at inflammatory components. As you've heard already today, temporal arteritis, any type of the hepatic zosters, any of those type of things, along with the fibromuscular dysplasia, increased risk for potential stroke. We talked about the protein C and the Leiden factor. Anticardiolipin antibody, which we would see with some of the MELASs, and the antiphospholipid antibodies, along with lupus. So when we move into the modifiable ones, these are the ones that we associate with increased risk, and we've got a number of different things of assessing risk around this, and we'll touch on them today, and they've probably been touched on in other lectures. Hypertension, atrial fibrillation, diabetes, previous history of cardiac disease, of course, alcohol use, smoking, sedentary lifestyle, and obesity, especially those that have central adiposity. Cigarette smoking, clearly, a 2-3% increase over non-smokers. There is about a 50% risk reduction after 2 years after stopping smoking. Spousal cigarette smoking may be associated with an increased risk as well, passive smoking. Alcohol consumption. Those that are heavy consumers of alcohol are at increased risk of both ischemic and hemorrhagic stroke. And as we age, it becomes even more prevalent around the hemorrhagic component. Blood pressure elevation might be a reasonable explanation of some of these earlies, but it's not complete. Light alcohol consumption associated with reduced ischemic and hemorrhagic stroke. Wine consumption, kind of with the red wine, and reasonable intake has associated positive attributes to decrease risk. So if we look at physical activity, our sedentary world of the whole metabolic syndrome is that people who do not have an established regular exercise routine are at increased risk of stroke. So therefore, doing 30 minutes a week, three times intervals, have a decreased risk of stroke. Physical active individuals have a lower risk of stroke or death than those with low activity. And this, of course, is very well understood because those people that are active walkers tend to have decreases in vascular resistance, which is results in lower blood pressure and better control of body weight, and of course, some of the other risk factors of glucose metabolism and cholesterol. So when we look at people that have a BMI greater than 25, they are at increased risk of stroke. As I mentioned earlier, abdominal adiposity is an increase of risk of stroke in men, but not in women. A randomized trial really found no effective dietary interventions to reduce the incidence of stroke, but we also, as you've heard in some of the others, some of the supplementations, and they are vast because people, there are vast consumption of this, can be an increase. And I think it's fair for us to talk about beta carotene and vitamin E as possibly not being additive. Hormone replacement. Stroke rates rise rapidly in women after menopause. Hormonal replacement therapy in postmenopausal women is associated with almost a 44% increase in stroke. This is slowly falling down as a big driver, but historically, about 10 years ago, this was not the case. Antithrombotic therapy. There are certain components of getting people to prophylactically when they're on their risk at a certain age to begin antiplatelet, daily low-dose aspirin to reduce coronary events. And it is helpful in people over the age of 45 to reduce the risk of ischemic stroke, particularly for women. But in low-risk people, taking an aspirin doesn't really reduce the risk of stroke. Vitamins, back to that. Beta-carotene, increased risk of cardiovascular death. Antioxidant supplements may increase mortality. And really, truthfully, we should not be given vitamins, especially, I'll throw into the B vitamins, to try to specifically lower homocysteine levels to try to reduce the risk of stroke. Sleep disorder breathing. You had a little bit of this yesterday. And I know there was an emphasis around this. One of the most classically missed is the sleep cycle. And whether it's cardiac disease, like congestive heart failure, or stroke, is that sleep disorder breathing and finding out how people sleep is very, very important. More than 50% of stroke patients have some form of obstructive sleep apnea. And it is linked with really a poor outcome and increased long-term stroke mortality. Falls. Falls are the number one reason that people over the age of 65 come to the hospital. If you've seen that 75% of strokes are occurring in people over the age of 64, falls is an incredible portion. This is one of the attributes of continuum of care. It's more as important as the drug regime, is making sure that the risk factors, both cognitive impairment, depression, polypharmacy, et cetera, are evaluated, that you do have an approach on the environmental factors and prevention, and making the home safe. Exercise, as well as calcium supplementation and bisphosphonates, help those individuals immensely after stroke. One of the last things on your mind when a person has a stroke is to evaluate for osteoporosis, but it's necessary and important that prevention and support can certainly help an unexpected fall or an unpreventable fall. Same thing with feeding and eating. One of the things that's very, very important upon discharge is that the dysphagia of a person that's had a stroke has been assessed. 50% of the patients with a unilateral hemiplegic stroke have dysphagia. And for patients that are having dysphagia, the options of potential alternatives and a proper eating is stressed and enforced because aspiration pneumonia is high and the relative outcome is not as good given the already predisposed issues that these individuals have. Early rehab. There's been a huge stress as multidisciplinary teams begin to evolve and grow around acute brain injury treatment is to maximize the rehabilitation early. The old adage, and it's reasonable for the boards, is that you waited for people to get better before sent them to acute rehabs. Give them time to kind of gain themselves. Actually, the data is completely opposite of that. That aggressive pushing an individual after a stroke as intensely as possible to rehab them is critical. And that following the old methods of having people get better before they rehab have good outcomes. And you really, so as you'll see with any of the multidisciplinary teams that you have in your hospitals, the push for acute rehab and maximizing that rehabilitation of the stroke patient is very, very important. So let's look a little bit about calculating risk. These are great things for a board question and giving any type of example. So identifying a person who has early risk of stroke after a TIA, it's really the ABCD2 criteria, whereas one is age, the other is blood pressure, clinical features like a unilateral weakness, speech disturbance, or symptoms and duration, as well as the concomitant second D, which is the diabetes. Those people can be stratified between 0 and 3 at low risk, 4 to 5 for moderate risk, and really 6 to 7 at high risk. Reasonable word question. So types of drugs. Two types, ischemic and hemorrhagic. 70% of the strokes are ischemic. Can be looked at as either thrombotic or embolic. Thrombotic ones are more from atherosclerosis, where the embolic is coming from some kind of plaque from either the large vessels or the heart. Hemorrhagic is usually intracerebral, usually related to hypertension, and in some instances, an amyloid angiopathic changes. And then we have subarachnoids, which are related primarily to barrier aneurysms of the circle of the vessels. So it doesn't matter in a stroke where the insult is. As you see here in a classic example, you have an atherosclerotic thrombotic lesion. It doesn't matter whether it's bleeding there or whether it's a clot. You have that penumbra. Now, penumbra is going to be that area of the brain, much like we saw on the first film or the first slide. It has this area of insult. This is going to be what is going to be driving it. Even though the lesion's here, this is our insult. And minimizing that tissue to be affected is the critical aspect of how we drive that approach. So, let's take a quick look through what really gets affected kind of slowly, you know, kind of as we go through some of the components here. When we look at atherosclerosis, it's really primarily internal carotid, middle cerebral, and vertebrovascular is the most common. Symptoms are usually a slow, stepwise progression of symptoms. And in the thrombotic strokes, those are the ones that have the TIAs. The embolic strokes do not. Other causes of that are going to be hypercoagulable states, polycythemia. It can be some infections, as well as it can be some vascular abnormalities, not to mention thrombocytosis, which can add to the viscosity of the spleen, adding to the clot formation. So as I said earlier, embolic is usually not preceded by TIA. It usually comes with the heart or the arch of the aorta. It usually affects the middle greater than the posterior, greater than the anterior cerebral arteries. And the nerve deficits are usually worse at onset. And then the weakness is usually greater in the distal extremities than the proximal. So let's look a little bit about strokes by region. As I mentioned earlier, it's very acceptable, and we'll see a little bit later, that you get symptoms and then try to rise back. So middle cerebral, one of the most common, and probably one of the most common ones that I have seen when I take my board test, is you have contralateral hemiplegia, you have contralateral hemianesthesia, you have homonymous hemianopsia, you have impaired conjugate gaze in the opposite direction of where the lesion is. If it is the non-dominant hemisphere, you will have impaired spatial deficits. If it's in the dominant hemisphere where the lesion occurs, you will have impaired language. If the lesion is high, you'll have greater loss in the face and upper extremities than the distal. And if it's in the main trunk, you will have diffuse symptoms throughout. Anterior cerebral is usually the most affected of the distal contralateral leg. So if they were looking for getting you to see if you could discern an anterior cerebral artery, they would be talking about the distal contralateral leg. You have associated urinary incontinence, gait abnormalities, and if it includes the corpus callosum, that patient will not be able to name what they touch. They will have tactile anomia. Posterior cerebral artery occlusion, you have contralateral homonymous hemianopsia, vision changes, usually upper quadrantopsia. You have mild contralateral hemiplegia and anesthesia, and you will have color anomia if the corpus callosum is damaged. There will be associated memory loss. And if the occlusion is bilateral, this memory will be severe and persistent. And so there will be very little likelihood that they'll be returned back to normal baseline. That's important because people, the next question after you say the person has had a stroke, the person will say, will they return to normal? In some instances, yes. In some instances, we're not sure. And in some instances, we kind of know. So single hemisphere injury. If we're involving a unilateral hemisphere, it usually does not affect the paraspinal muscles. It does not affect the pharynx, nor the jaw, or the forehead. If any of these above are affected, then you would think that we'd be dealing with a bilateral infarct, hemispheric, or a brainstem infarct. Vertebrobasilar artery occlusion, usually associated with brainstem strokes. There's bilateral extremity and motor sensory dysfunction. There's usually associated quadriplegia in severe cases. This is an area, of course, because it's in the brainstem where we have cross motor and sensory deficits. It can be an associated Horner syndrome. And you will have those cerebellar signs of ataxia, nausea, vomiting, and stupor. And there will be associated cranial nerve dysfunction because of the association of the insult. Lateral medullary syndrome, also known historically as Wallenberg syndrome, has that triad of nausea, vomiting, and nystagmus with an ipsilateral hormonal syndrome. There's also vocal cord and palate weakness, and you will have ipsilateral face hemianesthesia and contralateral body hemianesthesia. Lacunar strokes are those primarily due to hypertension. The reason they're called lacunar strokes is because those little arteries of Bouchard that are very, very small get injured. The area becomes ischemic over time, and they develop little lacunes that can develop these cysts in the brain, and you will have a pure hemiplegia and hemisensory deficit. If you get multiple bilateral frontal lobe lacunes, can cause a pseudo-bulbar palsy. So, let's look at the workup for stroke. We need the history, we understand why, family history, genetic. We need imaging of the brain initially, why we're doing that, differentiate bleed versus regular. We need the standard workup of metabolics, EKG. And essentially, if you look at the schematic on the right of the slide, that non-contrast CT and then getting some CT angiography to determine where our circulation is. If you have MR capability, you should get an NGS. You want to look at that diffusion-weighted imaging. If you know, you go to a CT perfusion scan. And really, from the standpoint of intervention, if it's within that six-hour period, and you have that penumbra, and I'm hoping I can get my slide so we can show that, is you would want to go and do intra-arterial therapy specifically on that. If no, then we would go to magnetic resonance perfusion scan, but that would give us a really good, better time, real time area that's involved so we can look at the lesions to proceed with the treatment. So if we look at ischemic stroke treatment from the thrombolysis standpoint, it's really from the focus of what's pertinent to the boards. I think it's important for the one to know that you will not proceed over 3 hours. And remember, from the onset of the symptoms, and remember that's the last time that person was confirmed
intact and physically intact, that we would treat the blood pressure gradually. We would use the antiplatelet regime and evaluate whether we have intra-arterial therapies we recently talked about, or a mechanical thrombectomy, based on the services you have and where you're actually treating this member. The contraindications, there's some absolutes. I wouldn't think they would be controversial on this. I think it would be someone that's had a recent bleed. But, and the relative ones, I don't think there's much of a board question, is I think probably the additional warnings. That's the ones kind of near the bottom after all your attention to. Age greater than 80, history of prior strokes and diabetes, any active anticoagulant use, and a pretty advanced stroke. And that would be an NIH score of greater than 25, which would be pretty diffuse. Post-acute care, sometimes it can be complex, sometimes it cannot be. I think you probably saw in the cardiology lectures more about the non-valvular atrial fib and how we can use some of those antiplatelets. For purposes of the board, a person has had a stroke in its post-treatment, you would want to go with an aspirin. Your xanthine compound, you would want to go with Agrinox. If that person was allergic to aspirin, it would be Plavix. All of these have places and purposes, but it's not the proper place on the board exam to have that discussion. Just as good clarity that Plavix and aspirin used together has no benefit except you're keeping you awake about bleeding. And the key is that there is no data that supports using 100 milligrams of aspirin versus 900 milligrams of aspirin offers any clinical difference. Essentially, then managing the underlying causes, making sure vascularly you're good, making sure your diabetes are under control, talking about some of the lipids as we've discussed, as well as creating a non-stimulant with the tobacco or the alcohol, and then really addressing anything that you found with advanced carotid stenosis for surgical evaluation and discussion. So let's look at the CHADS too. Once again, another one is stroke risk with atrial fibrillation. And I'll give you an example. 35-year-old guy comes into the hospital or in the emergency room. He's in atrial fibrillation. He has no medical history. He immediately gets a echocardiogram that is normal. He converts during that time to sinus rhythm. What's his CHADS score? Zero, right? So if you get a board question with that, and they were classified as low risk, you would send that person home on aspirin if they weren't allergic to aspirin, right? That's a good, fair board question. So make sure you feel comfortable with those. Intracerebral hemorrhage. I actually had a discussion with a gentleman over here, I think, about that. We talked about headaches this morning. This is very important. We're differentiating the migraines from cluster headaches, talking about ice picks, the worst headache of your life. We've all been trained that if a person comes in and they say, this is the worst headache of my life, and there's an associated neurological change, we think about bleed. So let's look at intracerebral hemorrhages. Amyloid angiopathy is one of the culprits. It commonly causes recurrent bleeds. It's usually associated with people that are greater than 65 years of age, just subcortical. It can cause multi-infarction. Amyloid angiopathies are also found in our patients that are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Intracerebral hemorrhage, which is one of the most common, it's usually hypertension related. It's gradual and smooth onset of symptoms. And it usually affects the pain more than the thalamus, more than the pons, more than the cerebellum as a percentage of occurrence. So with a putamen bleed, you have contralateral hemiparesis, sensory loss, and anoxia. It kind of just likes like middle cerebral infarct from symptoms. Thalamus, you have a contrahemiplegia, hemianesthesia, and the sensory loss will be much more than the motor. And from a pons, you have classic pinpoint pupils. You will have complete paralysis and have some decerebral posturing. And cerebellum, you have acute dizziness, ataxia, vomiting, the classical triad that we talked about just a few minutes ago. And no mentation change or loss of consciousness. And so when you have a person with the classic thunderclap headache, then you've got to be and associated neurological symptoms, you've got to think about bleeding. That's how you differentiate it. These individuals may actually be alert. They may be confused, or they may be comatose. And there are sometimes there will be no focal neurological signs. Neck stiffness is classic, but it's not always present. CT misses bleeds quite regularly. Lumbar puncture for a board exam, but the important to have the xanthochromic supernatant is diagnostic. If the LP is negative, it can be hours before blood gets into the CSF. As we all know, it can be a while before we can even find some of the bleeds on imaging. The key here is the watch out. Is you can re-bleed even after stabilized from a vasospasm within 24 hours. Critical issues for an internist here are appropriate neurosurgical consult, really handling the ABCs, making sure that you're managing the acid base appropriately, edema management, and following intracranial pressure monitoring and seizure management. Quickly into multiple sclerosis. It's a disease that involves the brain, spinal cord, and optic nerve. It's 10 times more common in normal northern latitudes, usually onset between 20 to 50. It's a mononuclear inflammation with a demyelination, with axon sparing. And there's a dendrological cell loss and astrocyte proliferation. The symptoms, it's really a mononeuropathy multiplex, as we talked about. You can have optic neurisis, you can have ophthalmoplegia, you can have diplopia, extremity weakness. And the board always likes to remember the Lemnitzky sign, which is paresthesias radiating down the spine into the extremities on neck flexion. So when you look right here, I did on my other slide deck, I have all this stuff. If you look right here, this is the proliferation that you have on the H&E side showing really active MS histopathologically, which I hope they would never do. So there's a multitude of types of multiple sclerosis. The one we know best is relapsing remitting. But you can have a clinically isolated syndrome where they have one episode and there's no recurrence. And the relapsing remitting is one of the most common. The attacks follow by none and then reoccurs at general angles, at general points in time. And then we begin to move into secondary progressive, which is really stage two of relapsing remitting, where there's no period of remission, just continues to worsen. And then you can have a primary progressive that just there's a gradual decline with few plateaus. And then there's progressive relapsing, which is rare, and it just progresses right till death. And then there's one extremely rare variant called the Marburg variant that you get the initial episode and there's death within a few months. MRI is the test of choice, primarily looking for white plaques in the brain and spinal cord. Evoked action potentials will show those silent lesions, and that's from that axonal break. Lumbar puncture will show an increased IgG and oligoclonal IgG band in CSF. Boards have always liked you to be able to know that. The important thing is that you do not have to have a lumbar puncture to diagnose multiple sclerosis and that there's an elevated protein. So here's a classic example. As you look at white stuffs in brain of a person with a plastic white plaque lesions on CT of multiple sclerosis. Here's some more examples. And if you see this sporadically, more diffuse, and we'll look at one in a little while, it can be other syndromes. So it's real important to be able to differentiate this because some of these have very similar patterns. Treatment, acute phase is really going to be steroids. We'll get 500 to 1,000 milligrams IV in the initial phase for about 5 days. Plasma exchange for severe deficits. But really, the treatment in the outpatient has grown quite robust. It's become to evolve much like hypertension. We have oral immunomodulators as well as self-administered. And technically for the boards, it is reasonable that they want you to find a beta interferon for a person with a treatment of relapsing or re-emitting. A Galenia or an Aubagio oral is certainly appropriate. I wouldn't think they'd ask you to differentiate between those. I think ones that have failed the beta interferons, whether it's Avonex or whatever, moving to the next phase of a Tesarbi, or if we have a chronic advance with the methotrexate or however, would certainly be something that would be pushing the limit for a fair board question for an internist. One of the things that's important about Lemtrada in relapsing remitting is that it can only be used in HIV negative individuals. So I told you there's a lot of things with, let me go back one. One of the most important things here is really the McDonald criteria. I hope we can find this slide. It's missing on here, but it's very, very important. If we don't get it today, I will make sure I get it sent so I can get put on the website. But it's really important for you to feel comfortable with the McDonald criteria for a diagnosis of MS. If you have a person who has two episodes with documented lesions, you really don't have to go any further to document. It's the clinical isolated syndrome where you really have two episodes and you have the two lesions. Do you feel comfortable if a person only has one episode but two lesions? So I want to, even though it's not so much for the board, I want you to feel comfortable with that in your practice as you get with that. The McDonald criteria is a good guide for this. But let's go back to this. We got a 34-year-old with ataxia, ophthalmoplegia, paresthesia of the legs intermittently with a massive weight loss over the past few months. His history is significant for HIV and has been on ganciclovir and protease inhibitors, and T-cell counts have remained less than 200. His mentation is going quickly, and he has no memory and has stopped eating. What do you think this is? Well, the reason I have it here, I want to demonstrate, there is no ventricle loss here, right? So this is not a massive protruding lesion. This is more of a white plaque. So this is, you look at this and say, okay, this is not a stroke. And this is not MS because it doesn't really look that way. It's usually little plaques. This right here is kind of classic of a syndrome called progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. And this can come from a number of different things. The reason I point this out is that many drugs, this can be a side effect of. In this example, it was from proteases. It can also occur without drugs from the JC virus, as you know. And so it's another white plaque disease. But as you can clearly see, you'll have normal parenchyma with just a kind of diffuse white infiltration here. Central pontine myelinolysis, or CPM, is a condition that occurs in patients with severe hyponatremia, especially if their sodium is corrected too aggressively. There can be associated quadriparesis, mutism, pseudobulbar palsy, a swallowing deficit, and the treatment for that is, of course, correct the sodium slowly. There are many tumors and other things that can affect the pons that can create this type of, of, of issue, but this is a fair triad here of quadriparesis, mutism, and cerebral paralysis associated with CPM. And then some of it can be related to pathology, some of it is iatrogenically induced as we try to correct the sodium for hyponatremic patient